Our final talk of the morning session is by Ben Guest, and he is going to tell us about spectral index maps of pulsar wind nebulae.
Okay, hi, I'm a PhD student from the University of Manitoba. So thank you to the organizers for giving me this opportunity, and thank you to the rest of you for your time. So I'm going to talk about spectral index maps and what we can learn from them. So not everyone does pulsar wind nebula study, so to introduce them, they're synchrotron sources, which means that the emission spectrum follows a power law. And I have sort of a bad habit of using photon index and spectral index interchangeably, but the only difference is sort of what units you want to work with, whether you want to work with frequency and flux density or photon counts and energy. And so I'm doing all of this in X-ray, so we're really talking about the photon index. So when you're dealing with synchrotron radiation, you have short lifetime for higher energy particles, and so what this means is that you get a softening of the spectral index with distance from the pulsar. As well, particles radiate close to where they're accelerated, and so when you observe an X-ray, you see all of this wonderful morphology, like the Jet and Taurus seen in the Crab Nebula. Variability in pulsar wind nebula has traditionally been observed through a few techniques. Either you look at motion of persistent features, like was seen in Vela, or you have the famous WISPs in the Crab Nebula, or WISP-like features seen in G21. This is an example. Or you see sudden brightening or outbursts, like magnetar outbursts, like the one seen in KESS-75. And so maybe this is foreshadowing that maybe there's another technique we can use to find variability. But before we get into that, what is a spectral map? Simply, it's a map of the spectral index across a remnant. But creating this from real data is challenging because you need a finite number of photon counts in order to fit a spectrum. So how do you decide what regions to use without losing all of your spatial information? Well, luckily, there was a contour-binning routine developed by Sanders, which follows the surface brightness of an input image and creates regions that fit together like puzzle pieces, completely covering your field of observation. And so this is an example of a Chandra observation of G54. And when we run this routine, these are regions that we get. So to get into some data, I'll introduce G21. This is a pleuronic composite supernova remnant. It's also a Chandra calibration target, which means it was observed really regularly over its lifetime to date. And if you stack all of these observations, you not only see the bright pulsar wind nebula in the center, but you also see that there is a faint shell of X-ray emission here. So I'm not going to be talking about that shell today, but if for some reason you're not interested in pulsar wind nebulae, we can talk about the shell later. But hopefully we'll see that the pulsar wind nebula is actually very interesting. So if we do a spectral map of this pulsar wind nebula and we fit observations simultaneously from 1999 to 2014, these are the observations that are available, and then we color the regions with the best fit value of the photon index that we find. And we actually see that there's something we haven't seen before. So there is this plume of harder emission to the north of the pulsar. The pulsar is not marked here by this green cross. And we also identify hard regions nearby, which we identify as possibly the termination shock, which also hadn't been seen before in G21. But we have 15 years of observations. So are we missing anything by just basically putting all of these together and simultaneously fitting the spectra? So instead, we can group observations by year and create individual spectral maps. And when we do that, we see that we're actually missing a lot of information. So I'll let this run through, but it appears to show that the stable G21 calibration target pulsar wind nebula actually had multiple outbursts during this time, where we see significant variability here in this northern plume. And it seems to show some period on the order of 2 years or so. But how sure are we that this is a real result and not just statistical errors? So we need to understand our errors. And so to do that, I created what I've called significance images, where we take the difference between two spectral maps and then divide by the sum of the errors for each of them. And any region which gives you a value approaching or exceeding absolute value of one, we deem significant. So the change is not allowed by our errors, effectively. And we see that comparing 2000 to 2005 spectral map, we actually see significant hardening in this northern plume. We also see significant softening in this direction to the south. So this is interesting, but is this something that's unique to G21? So we can look at other pulsar nebulae. So 3C58, this is a pulsar nebula powered by 65 millisecond pulsar. It's embedded in thermal emission. It also has this wonderful jet and torus morphology, as well as all of these complex twists and turns and loops. So when we repeat this sort of spectral map analysis, where we run into a problem. The presence of thermal emission means we can't just fit power law across the remnant, but we can create a chi-squared map and then just go into regions that exceed some value and add a thermal component, and then we get a nice fit to all of the regions across the remnant, where initially we see this thermal region to the outside, making our fits inadequate. So once we've done this, we can again look at changes in our spectral maps, and we see that there is a ring-like feature surrounding the pulsar that has significantly hardened between the 2000 observation and 2003. Okay, so we're 2 for 2 so far. What else can we look at? KES-75. This is a Plarionic composite remnant. It was caught undergoing a magnetar-like outburst in 2006, which it showed brightening and softening of the pulsar, as well as brightening of the primary southern jet. So when we look at this with our spectral maps, we see slight hardening of this southern jet here, followed by significant softening over the decade from 2006 to 2016. Clearly shown here in the significance image, we also see significant hardening in the opposite direction of a counter jet. Okay, 3 for 3 so far. This is looking interesting. G11, this is a Plarionic composite remnant. Still going to work. In this supernova remnant, the pulsar nebula is heavily obscured by thermal emission. And so it was also a sort of proof of concept, is can we apply this technique to objects like this? So we need to treat it in a little bit of a different method. So first, we filter our image to 3.5 to 8 keV. This is where the non-thermal emission is dominant. And then we run our contour binning algorithm to generate regions. And again, we see it looks like there's something going on here. But when we then look at our significance image, we see that we can't say that there is any significant change going on. And this is mainly the result of the three observation periods, so 2000, 2003, and 2013. Only 2013 had a deep observation. And so the errors are simply too large in our short earlier observations to make any conclusive statements. And last, I'll look at G54, as we mentioned earlier as well. It's a Plarionic composite remnant. It has this very bright ring here, identified as a termination shock or jet or a torus and jet features. And so when we do this spectral map analysis, while it looks like there may be something going on, we again can't say for sure that there are any significant changes that have occurred. And we're in the same the same situation as with G11 in that our 2008 observation is nice and long, so we have good statistics, but the 2001 observation is just too short to be able to make any conclusive statements. And so after showing this, I'll finish with a few statements. Spectral maps are an incredibly powerful tool that we can use to study the winds in pulsar wind nebulae. And while as a whole, the emission may be remarkably stable, if we have high resolution imaging combined with sensitive spectroscopy, which Chandra is absolutely perfect for, we can start to see that there is more variability in this wind that we haven't seen before. And I'll also remind everyone to use caution when, even when you're dealing with faint sources, you want to be careful sort of blindly simultaneously fitting or merging observations taken at different times. Thank you.
Thanks, Ben. Do we have questions? Okay, so Eve, go ahead that way. Eve first, then Yossi.
So this is a very interesting approach, but the question, as you said, is whether the variations that you seem to see are really real. Could you go back to the last slide on G21.5, where you discuss this significance? Because the way you describe it here looks to me like you're saying if it's more than one sigma, you consider it significant. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's basically if the difference between the two is larger than can be accounted for by error, you're saying it's a real result.
I think what Eve is asking is when you say by errors, how are those errors defined, right?
Oh, sorry, yeah, I'm using the two sigma errors to get the confidence interval, and then if the difference is larger than the sum of that, then it's significant.
Okay, Yossi?
So do you have any idea on what might be causing these changes? So one thing that I find interesting is these are a few light years big, and your time scales are 1 year, or particle can travel maximum 1 light year within the pulse wind,
right,
pulse or wind nebula, because it says something about the motion of particles inside the nebula.
Yeah, so for the 3C58, we looked at it, and for this one, it had to be, if it was due to an outburst from the pulsar, then it would correspond to a speed greater than, I believe it was 40% the speed of light, just based on time between observations and distance it would have to travel. That's the only one I've really looked at that aspect of so far, but it could be something other than sort of a change in the particle spectrum, whether you have magnetic field amplification causing the spectrum to change somehow, or something else going on.
Other questions? Daniel?
Thanks. So this is really interesting technique. I might have missed this when you said it, but have you actually gone back to one of the ones that show significance and just extracted the spectrum for the two different observations and actually looked at what your spectral fits tell you in terms of significance?
I guess I haven't. I mean, I've looked at them in that, like, nothing weird is going on in the spectrum. Like, they're both still well represented by power law. But as far as digging deeper into that, I haven't done that.
Reno?
So I was wondering, if you actually fix some specific areas, in the case of this Passover nebula, for which we have many observations, and you see the evolution in time of the of the spectral index, do you see a sort of continuity or not? And a related question, if you have two observations which are very close in time, like 1 month or so, do you have a better consistency?
So I want to make sure I'm understanding your question. The first part you're saying, if I look at, say, just one region and look at its progression with time, how does it change? So I believe I have a slide. So here, this is the progression of this northern plume here. And it's both the count rate and photon index. So this is how it changes over that time period. So it is rather erratic. And for the second part, I'm still developing this, and so I haven't tried different time periods in sort of what I group and what I don't. Generally, I tried to keep it within, if the observations were in a couple weeks or within a month, I would just simultaneously fit them. But for the targets I've looked at, there isn't all that much opportunity to do finer refinement than that, just because the observations aren't there.
Other questions? Following up sort of on what Reno was getting at, I'm not sure that I completely understand the significance of these things, because I don't quite understand the effective number of sigma, if you will, of the results. But one thing that might be of interest is for observations that are long. For example, I know that for 3C58, you must have compared a 50 kilosecond one with a, I can't remember, 300 kilosecond observation. That 300 kilosecond one could be split into six 50 kilosecond ones. They were all taken pretty close to the same time. And you could just say, I'm going to pretend those were far apart. Do I still see that flickering? Because if so, I mean, maybe it means it's happening really, really fast. Maybe it means that it's systematic.
Yeah, that's a great point. I can definitely do that.
Okay, let's thank Ben again and all of the speakers from this morning. We now have a coffee break until 11:30.